We get a chance in this hour to get to know, secondhand, people who are often at the center of controversy in the United States because they are refugees and they are young, young enough to attend school. You thought your teen years were tough. Imagine moving to a foreign country, not by choice, and not knowing much of anything about either the culture or the language. That is the situation in which Helen Thorpe found a classroom of high school students in Denver. She profiles them and their learning process in the book The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. Helen Thorpe is a journalist with works in many media, ranging from The New Yorker to This American Life on public radio. She's also written two previous books, Just Like Us and Soldier Girls. Soldier Girls brought her to the exchange in September of 2014. So, Helen Thorpe, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show again.
So, talk about the genesis of this project. What got you to think about refugees and more specifically about a high school?
You know, my parents immigrated to this country with me when I was just 1 year old. My mom grew up on a dairy farm in rural Ireland, and my dad grew up on the wrong side of Dublin. So I've always been interested in stories about people changing countries and starting over and making a new life somewhere else. I found South High School, I was just interviewing different people about the refugee crisis, and an education reporter said, have you, you know, really looked at what's happening inside South High School? They were the designated place in our public school system where kids were sent if their schooling had been interrupted, typically by war, and also where kids went if they spoke foreign languages other than Spanish. So by default, then, they got essentially the bulk of our city's teenage refugees. And when I went, they'd been doing this for 20 years, and I showed up, and the principal said, oh, I read your first book, Just Like Us, about undocumented students, and I know you'll treat our kids with respect, and you're welcome in this building. You can be in any classroom that you want for as long as you want. And I had never had that experience as a journalist, sort of being just welcomed in.
Yeah, it's usually the opposite for journalists.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then it kind of became a challenge to honor that and to handle the situation appropriately, because these are very, you know, vulnerable kids in many respects. I didn't want to interrupt their ability to adjust, you know.
Sure, yeah, I understand that. But you know, you also needed to be able to communicate with them, and I noticed you had to hire some translators. How many altogether?
Well, when I walked into their classroom, I could not even say I'm a journalist to the kids and be understood, because they were there were 22 kids in total by the end of the year, and 14 different languages in the room, and 5 different alphabets. So, you know, they're coming from all corners of the world and often arriving with zero English. So I hired 14 different interpreters so I could explain who I was and why I was in their classroom, and that it was their choice if they wanted to participate in the book or not.
Tell us a bit about Eddie Williams, the teacher. I know you've changed some names in the book. I'm not sure if his is one of them. But
you know, the only names that I changed were two students without legal status who were seeking asylum. They had come from El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
In every other case, I used a student's real first name and the teacher's full name. That's his real name. Well, he's 6'4". He's a soccer player. He's a super dedicated teacher. He's one of those kinds of teachers who, you know, some teachers are more entertainers. They're very outgoing. He's at the other end of the spectrum personality-wise. He's introverted and very sensitive. So his gift was to meet each kid right where they were. He got to know each student far more deeply than maybe the average teacher, and he knew what kind of learner they were and what sort of assistance they needed. And he was very skilled and humble, and like he didn't show off, but I grew to just have enormous admiration for him. He saw me in the classroom, and I was sitting in a corner with my notebook, and he didn't want it to be that way. So he sort of drew me in, and you know, would ask me to help a kid read or help him with a game he was trying to play with the kids, where they would learn English but have fun at the same time. And he was very, very good at stitching the room together like that. He didn't want anybody on the periphery. He wanted everybody interacting with everybody else.
But, you know, he did not have the benefit of translators. So I mean, where does he start in a room full of non-English speakers?
That's one of the big questions I had at the outset of the book. Like, how does this even work? How does an English language acquisition teacher communicate English when he can't speak the languages that the kids are showing up with? Eddie Williams was fluent in Spanish, but not the 13 other languages that these kids spoke, like Arabic or Tigrinya or languages that I hadn't even heard of in some cases. So he taught through immersion, so he would just speak English, but he would use so much body language and he would communicate so many things visually or nonverbally that they would get the gist of what he was doing. So he would walk around the room and stick out his hand and say, "Hi, nice to meet you." And the first time, you know, he did it, they didn't have a clue what he was saying. But as he went to each student, they began to get the sense, oh, this is a greeting. And just by repetition and making them repeat these things, and then he would write them down and ask them to write them down, you know, they just slowly start to acquire English in this way. Watching him use body language is amazing. Like if he said, "Open your books," he would pantomime opening a book. He was really, really skilled at getting across, making the words he was saying comprehensible to them.
There's a really interesting point you bring up in here about learning languages beyond childhood. And it's not just the brain getting less plastic, you point out, but the facial muscles.
Yeah. There's a student in the room named Sartu, and his family is originally from Burma. You know, Burma's back in the news again with Rohingya refugees streaming out of there right now as we speak. In this case, his family, they were Karen-speaking, part of the Karen ethnic minority, but left for similar reasons, very repressive military regime, cracking down on their villages, committing atrocities. Sartu had been born in a refugee camp in Thailand. When he got to this country, he spoke Thai, Burmese, and Karen. But all of those languages are so far away from English that they use different sounds.
All right, we'll come back and discuss the rest of Sartu's story. It's very interesting. The book is called The Newcomers by Helen Thorpe. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Some of us really enjoyed high school. Some of us really didn't. But very, very few of us had to experience high school as refugees from other countries, not knowing language, culture, or much of anything about the new environment into which we were thrust. That is the situation covered by Helen Thorpe in her book, The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. She spent more than a year at South High School in Denver, which is the place where the English Language Acquisition Program is run for the city. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about language acquisition in general, and the general assumption is that it's harder because your brain starts getting a little less plastic as you get old. But you were talking about the facial muscles themselves change. Sartu, this student who was a native Karen speaker from Myanmar, wasn't able to make the sounds of the English language.
Right, and thanks for saying Myanmar. The kids still say Burma because that's what it was called when they were living there, but that's a country that's changed its name. The muscles in the face tend to solidify around the sounds that your native language makes, say around the age of 11, 12. So by the time Sartu arrived at South High School, the muscles in his face were formed to produce the sounds of Karen or Thai or Burmese, the three languages he spoke. But English is so far away from those languages that it literally uses different muscles. The sounds we make are so different. And so he had a terrible time trying to pronounce English words. For him, it was a real struggle. And of course, it's an entirely new alphabet. The languages that he spoke use three different alphabets, but not the Latin script that we use.
As you mentioned, by the end of the year, 20 kids, 14 languages, 5 alphabets in that classroom. You noticed some distinct phases in this language acquisition class. How mysterious a process to you as you watch this unfold?
Well, at the outset, I was mystified because the kids were totally silent. And I thought, well, first of all, I thought, how will I even write a book about kids who aren't speaking? This isn't going to be very dramatic. And then, you know, the kids, of course, blossomed over the school year. But I didn't understand that that silent phase is actually a critical moment. It's recognized in the literature around language acquisition, and it's called the silent phase, where your brain can't yet produce sound, And yet, nonetheless, your brain is listening furiously. So if you try to speak a foreign language at first, it's almost like you're closed down and you can't make the language come out of your mouth. But your ears, your brain is in a listening mode. So you're listening very acutely, and you're actually absorbing far more than you realize. And then when your brain is comfortable enough, you will start to produce not perfect sentences, not grammatical sentences, but the right sounds and the right words, maybe not in the right order, and then producing full sentences. The kids by the end of the school year were entering a phase called intermediate fluency, where they were producing full sentences that were basically structured the way English sentences are. That was another thing. A lot of languages, they don't put words in the same order that we do. So Arabic is famous for putting verbs first. So if you and I were speaking, I would say, speaking, you and I are, like something like that.
Yeah, I know. I had flashes of Yoda when I noticed that. But it's not
exactly.
It's not unusual that languages are structured differently from ours. Yeah.
Yeah.
And took some getting used to. So language aside for a moment, when the students were a little more able to have discussions with you, and sometimes through interpreters, obviously, how much discussion in class of how the teens got there?
So one of the huge challenges for me as a journalist and a human being given so much access to spend an entire school year in this classroom with kids who had lived through war, trauma, all kinds, they had just seen things a person should never have to see. I knew I couldn't just be a journalist and start peppering them with questions in the middle of their school day. It would be traumatic for them mm-hmm. if I were to try to interview them. So I kept my conversations at lunchtime when I did bring in an interpreter very general. I let them speak about what they wanted to tell me. And if it seemed like they'd lived through actual warfare, I just asked if I could meet their parents. I did not want to subject the kids to my own curiosity about their journey while they're at school. And I thought it was much more fair to ask a mom or a dad, do you want to participate in this book? Do you want to tell me your family's journey? So there was an Iraqi family, for example, with two sisters in the room, Jacqueline and Mariam. They mentioned witnessing terrible car bombings. I did a little research about the name of their town, and I saw that hundreds of their neighbors had been killed in a series of car bombings that happened on one day. And I thought, I cannot grill these girls about what they witnessed, the bloodshed, people that they knew dying in the streets of their town. But I went home and I met their mom, and over time, gained her trust. We had many meals together. She was a fabulous cook, made all kinds of Middle Eastern feasts. Generally, they wanted to sit on the floor, which is how they traditionally have a meal. So we did that together. And she then was very interested in telling her story because she had lost her husband during the Iraq War when he sided with the Americans. And she wanted fellow Americans to understand that they weren't on the other side of the Iraq War. They were on our side, and that's why they had been granted permission to come and live here.
Wow, that's quite a sacrifice. Yes, the book is called The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. Helen Thorpe is the author and our guest on The Exchange. So let's go there, because, the discussion of refugees leads inevitably to the talk of the political situation with
right.
refugees. And it was during that school year that Donald Trump, as a candidate, began his talk of refugees and excluding them, particularly Muslims, which would have left the people from Iraq out, at least at first, I think.
When we have these debates on Twitter or, with our very rapid news cycle, I think the debates happen at an incredibly superficial level. And we're not aware of that if we don't know what we don't know. So the actual refugee crisis is a lot more complex. It is not happening only in the Middle East. In this classroom, yes, there was a family from Iraq, and they had lived in Syria, so they did represent that story that we see all the time on the news and in the headlines. But the greatest number of kids were from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the country that has sent the most refugees to the United States in recent years. And there were several kids from Burma, another country that has sent an even greater number than any country from the Middle East. So we don't understand the refugee crisis very well, and we don't know why are those countries producing refugees necessarily, unless we follow international news. And that's hard to do. I myself, you know, I read newspapers, I try to stay up on the news, but I myself didn't feel that I knew a whole lot about some of these places when I was first meeting these kids, and I had to go educate myself. The room ended up mapping the global crisis. If a country was producing refugees, Eddie Williams got a kid from that place during that school year.
So moving essentially from the headlines to the classroom.
Yeah, I think our debates are just too superficial. We don't really have enough facts. And that's what I try to do in the book is tell a great story, really get you engaged with these kids, but also along the way share so much more that I think there's a much more intelligent debate we could have.
Certainly. And so with the effects on the lives of the students, so here they are in this new country that they barely understand. That,
yeah.
You know, they've got very little knowledge of language, culture, expectations, any of that stuff. And then it sounds like there was sort of this rolling introduction into Eddie Williams' classroom of more people as the year went on. In fact, it started, I think, 8 or 9 people as the year began. So how did the class sort of acclimate new people in? I mean, did everybody have to go back to square one?
Yeah, I mean, I think teachers generally aren't celebrated enough, but English language acquisition teachers are a subgroup of teachers who I think get even less respect sometimes because there's this idea that, you know, teaching basic English is somehow like less elevated. I don't know. There's like a bias almost in our minds about English language acquisition classes. Actually, when you're in the room, it's awe-inspiring, partly because of what you're describing. The kids showed up whenever their families arrived in the United States, and it wasn't all at the beginning of the school year. It was higgledy-piggledy all throughout the calendar. And Eddie Williams had to keep pushing the kids he'd had already and yet incorporate every new face, you know, as they turn up. And he would do that really well by incorporating the original students into helping him teach the new students, and it would be review for the kids he'd had for a while, new for the new kids. And he made it work, and I describe all of that hopefully in a way that's fun and amusing with a lot of humor. But I'm really celebrating what this teacher is doing because I can't imagine, you know, standing in front of that room and making it work in the way that he did. He was a master teacher, so he'd been doing this for a while, and when he wasn't teaching these kids, he was also going throughout the rest of the building, all over the high school, coaching other teachers. So he was just really, really, really good at, you know, that balancing act that you have to do when you've got kids all over the map in one room, and your job is to teach all of them.
Eddie Williams is the teacher we're talking about. He is the teacher in the English Language Acquisition Program at South High School in Denver, which is the subject of Helen Thorpe's book, The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, to talk about refugees, taking them in, educating them, getting them acclimated to America, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Eddie Williams had a story of his own. Why don't we go into that just a bit and what motivated him?
Eddie grew up in California in a border town. His mom had grown up in a Spanish-speaking household. Eddie's grandparents had immigrated from Mexico. His mother was placed into English language acquisition classes herself as a child. His mom's Latina. His dad is Anglo. And his mom told Eddie that when she was in those classes, it was in a different era, and she was made to feel incredibly ashamed for speaking Spanish, so much so that she actually hid her heritage as a Mexican-American from her children at first. So they identified only as Anglo initially, and she never revealed that she spoke Spanish to them. She didn't say she was of Mexican descent until they were older, and when she shared that with them, Eddie told me the story that his sister actually burst out crying because to be Mexican-American in that moment was to be inferior or to be looked down upon. And so I think Eddie himself, having that kind of background, he felt he really wanted every kid in his room, whether they spoke Swahili or Arabic, whether they wore a headscarf, no matter who showed up in his room, he wanted them to feel he would treat them with dignity, that he would treat them with respect, he would not humiliate them for speaking some other language or not yet knowing English, and he would work incredibly hard to build trust with them.
His level of inventiveness is really interesting, though. I smiled at his use of the melody from Frère Jacques. You know, Frère Jacques, to teach the days of the week. I mean, really, really clever stuff, and it works. I mean, but education aside, how careful does Eddie Williams have to be with the students, I mean, given the traumas they've been through?
Right. One of the amazing things about South is that there's this language that people use in education. They call it a trauma-informed school, and it means that
we've talked about trauma-informed care a fair amount. It's become something that's in use in a couple of organizations where we live.
Yeah. So the teachers, the administration, they understand the backgrounds these kids are coming from, and so they won't, you know, if a kid describes some difficulty that they have had, I mean, they're coming from countries where there may have been landmines going off. Many kids in the places that they're coming from, these war zones, they may have witnessed their home being burned down. They may have witnessed a rape. They may have been abducted. And if they reveal something like that to an adult in this school, the adults have been trained. They understand not to express shock or horror, which would make the child feel that they themselves were a bad person for having had that kind of background. Instead, the adults in this institution really are taught to expect that a child may show up with that kind of background, and yet to know that that kid has resilience and strength and, you know, can nonetheless learn a great deal. And there are all sorts of resources. The school counselor is skilled in working with kids who have trauma. But also, Eddie Williams had in his classroom a volunteer from Jewish Family Services, a therapist who would do group therapy with the kids and just provide an outlet. A lot of times they were just drawing, creating artwork, some way to express their feelings. And then they would come back into the room and share the artwork if they wanted to. And I remember a young woman from Africa holding up a beautiful drawing, and written on it were the words, sad, ashamed. And I knew by that point in the school year that I shouldn't ask her why. I shouldn't say, what made you feel that way? Because I could not do that to a young person in the middle of their school day. But I was able to sort of write about all of that, the moral dilemma that I faced, wanting to kind of honor her journey and what brought her there, and yet leave her in intact emotionally and not be the kind of opportunistic journalist who would try to, you know, get the story no matter what the impact would be on her emotionally.
We get the victims crying on camera thing. You didn't want to do that. Yeah,
I decided not to do that.
How much of an immersion was this for you, Helen? I mean, you know, these students are getting immersed in a language and a culture they don't know. You know the language and the culture, but you're essentially getting immersed in their milieu.
I found myself, through spending so much time with them in their classroom and then visiting them at home, I visited an Iraqi family, a Congolese family, and families from Burma at home, and those are the top three countries sending refugees to the U.S. It was such an education. Never have I learned so much in one 12-month span of time about the rest of the globe. And, you know, I came to understand a lot more my position in the world as an American. Just as an example, you know, reading about Burma, I didn't understand that there were kids growing up who would, like Sartu, move to the United States and had never taken a hot shower in their lives, never had a stove. It's obvious if you say it, of course, the standard of living is very different elsewhere, but I didn't understand the scale of the adjustment that a refugee teenager has to make if they're born inside of a refugee camp. And it's very humbling, you know, as an American. And I think we are a generous people. If we can come to understand more about the reality of life elsewhere, what it is that these families have lived through, and in the case of the Middle East, our involvement in that crisis, I really believe our natural reaction is to be generous and to say, what can I do to help?
Right, which is being challenged in a few quarters these days. The book is called The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. Helen Thorpe spent the better part of a year with these students and did come back after the summer to get to know them a little more. We'll come back and talk more about the experiences at South High School in Denver in the English Language Acquisition Program. Talk more with Helen and take some phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the journalist and author Helen Thorpe, joining us a second time. She joined us a few years ago to talk about a previous book called Soldier Girls. This time she's here with a book called The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. That classroom at South High School in Denver, Colorado. The English Language Acquisition Program takes in refugee teenagers from other countries. So imagine being in high school, not just as a teenager, but a high school in a country you don't know, in a culture you don't know, with a language you don't know. That's the situation the newcomers face, and Helen watched them through the better part of a year. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about the traumas they'd been through and some of their experiences. You mentioned Sartu had never taken a hot shower in his life by the time he got to Denver. But how much had their educations been disrupted? Had some of these people been on several stops, had been several years without seeing a teacher?
Yeah, let me just describe one story to kind of illustrate what can happen. So Jacqueline and Mariam are Iraqi sisters. They showed up in Eddie Williams' classroom in October 2015, just as the presidential election is getting underway and we're debating refugees. They had been looking for a safe home for 10 years at that point. So they were born in Iraq in Baghdad. Their dad, who was Christian, had sided with the U.S. military. He was targeted. He was working as a bodyguard protecting a judge working for the American-backed provisional government. The judge was assassinated. There was an attempt on his life. So the family fled from Iraq because of their allegiance to the U.S. military. They couldn't live there anymore. And the girls wound up doing, the family fled to what they thought would be a safe country, Syria.
Oh, boy.
So they're living in Damascus. The girls did all their schooling in Syria in their early years. All their elementary school years were spent in Damascus. But when the Syrian civil war happened, which was kind of an outgrowth of the war in Iraq, it was very related to our invasion of Iraq, ultimately civil society broke down with the level of violence, the level of car bombings. Parents were afraid to send their kids to school, and there was even a car bombing at the school that the girls attended, and some of their friends were killed. So their mom kept them home, as did the majority of Iraqi refugee families. And ultimately, the situation got so bad in Syria that 60% of school-aged children were not in school. Then they escaped to Turkey, but in Turkey, they were asylum seekers. They didn't have legal status. Their situation was a lot like being an undocumented Mexican immigrant in the United States. And so their mom had only an informal job. She couldn't find real work, and she was making so little money, the girls dropped out of school to support her. And again, the majority of refugee or asylum-seeking families did the same thing. So the girls' schooling was interrupted for very lengthy periods of time, more than once. That's a typical refugee child's story. Patches of schooling interrupted by patches of war where it's not possible to go to school.
And so, you know, we've been talking about the English language acquisition program with Eddie Williams, but the fact is they did have other classes. I mean, they're expected to learn the other things that people learn in high school. So how was their other subject matter addressed, particularly since their English was so poor at the beginning?
Right. So like, you know, high school kids across the United States, these girls and all the newcomers in this room had different periods throughout the day, but they had Eddie Williams for three whole periods in a row. So they did English language acquisition for basically half of every day. The rest of the day, they had math and science, and then they had, you know, gym classes, art or dance, something like that. The math and the science classes that they were in at South High School, this is kind of an unusual program, they had special instruction by a math teacher who knew that he was working with an English language acquisition population, and there were only English language acquisition students in his math room. So he would use many extra visual cues to communicate math. Like, so for example, one day when I was sitting in the math class with them to see how this was done, he was teaching them about slope. So they were plotting points on a line, x-axis, y-axis, and he was showing them a video of a roller coaster so they could get slope going up, slope going down. And then he had them standing up, putting their arms in a diagonal, you know, right arm up towards the ceiling, left arm down towards the floor. And he would say, show me ascending slope, show me descending slope. Then they would reverse the position of their arms. That use of their own bodies, it's called total physical response. It's a type of learning that's used very often in ELA classrooms, English language acquisition classrooms. Because if you teach a student who's not familiar with English, math in English, but you also have them stand up and use their body at the same time to kind of act out a math concept, they'll retain it better. Because the English is hard for them to remember, but the body language, it activates a different part of the brain.
It transcends language in a
sense.
Yeah. Goes right to the math center.
Yeah.
So expand the focus just a bit, because we've tended to focus just inside the classroom thus far. Tell us about the principal who pushed South High School in Denver to excel and be diverse.
Yeah. While I was there, when I first showed up at the high school, I was welcomed into the institution by this woman named Kristen Waters, who had overseen the flourishing of this embrace of refugee students. She had made South High School a place where they didn't just tolerate refugees or immigrants. They didn't simply develop an expertise in working with them, but they actually changed the school culture so that everybody else in the building got excited about the opportunity to know these kids. They were not ghettoized. If you go to South and you go to the epicenter socially of the school and you walk into the student senate where all the kind of cool kids who are running the show are concentrated, that room has an almost equal component, native-born and foreign-born. So some of the immigrant and refugee kids who learn a lot of English fast are going to wind up also running the show as part of the student senate. When I was there, there were a couple of white kids plus a very overachieving Iraqi student named Ula, and Ula was conducting a public speaking exercise for the whole student senate, and she had decided the kids should debate which is better, Coke or Pepsi, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. So it was really fun to see how far the kids could travel if they learned enough English.
Now, South High School is in a pretty well-to-do neighborhood. I wonder how much friction, if any, there is with the people who live nearby about the people who come in there, the refugees in particular.
Yeah, and at the beginning of Kristen Waters' time, there was a lot of friction, and a lot of the wealthier white families in the neighborhood especially were saying things like, well, it's great that you're diverting resources to help these poor refugees, but is my kid going to get the short end of the stick as a result? And over time, that attitude was just transformed to where during my time at the school, Kristen Waters left as principal. Her husband got a job in another state. She moved away. They were looking for a new leader. And all the parent community was concerned about was, how do we keep doing what we're doing? We don't, you know, if Kristen Waters leaves, we don't want to lose all this incredible diversity. They had kind of embraced the idea that their own kids were learning all kinds of things that were incredibly valuable about the world by rubbing shoulders all the time with kids from all over the world. And they liked this United Nations kind of feel in the school hallways, and they just wanted to know who would preserve that. And then they decided to hire a teacher who, like Eddie Williams, had an English language acquisition background as their next principal.
Yeah, to give an idea of what a spark plug Kristen Waters is, I was just perusing some stuff in the Denver Post from 2007. So even before she got to South High School, she was making waves about the way money was allocated and how people were taught in the Denver school district. So always fairly aggressive in her approach, or assertive, let's put it that way.
Right. Really strong leader, visionary.
So let's talk about your role in the classroom, because we've already established that you couldn't just watch. You ended up taking part, and Eddie Williams encouraged you to take part. What did you?
Yeah.
How did you help the students with their learning?
You know, all my life, I've been trained as a journalist, starting off at newspapers and magazines, and all my life I was told to have a certain objective distance on my subjects and not to get too involved emotionally. And with this project, I decided that was not the right approach. I wanted to write more subjectively about, I wanted to drop that journalist guise. I didn't want to be objective about these kids. I wanted to write about my subjective experience being in the room with them and just kind of having my heart opened up by the experience of getting to know kids who had lived through so much already. My admiration for them just grew over the course of the year as they began to share their stories with me and the stories began to unfold. So Eddie Williams at the outset had me sitting and reading with somebody, or you know, there would be little discussion groups, and I as an English speaker wasn't, you know, somebody else that they could listen to or try to answer back if I asked them questions. So he was using me in that way. But there was one boy from the Congo, Methuselah, who he was the kid in the classroom who was learning the most, the fastest. Ultimately, Eddie Williams would recommend that Methuselah skip a year and a half of instruction.
Wow.
So in his second year of schooling, I watched him start reading To Kill a Mockingbird because he was just a rocket ship of learning. So early in the year, Methuselah figured out if he would walk over to me as I was sitting at my little table and put down his work in front of me, I would correct any mistakes he made in his sentences, which I thought was very, you know, smart of Methuselah to see me as this underutilized resource. And then other kids kind of began flocking over, following him. And also the kids, because they appreciated, I visited some kids, I went to their church, or one of the kids became an amazing track star. I would go to his track meets. And it meant a lot to them when I would share a meal with their parents or turn up at their church and sit through a four-hour church service or go to a track meet. And they started, you know, like the track star was giving me little shoulder bumps in the hallway. He gave me a gift, which was a crucifix. He's very religious, and he wanted to say, thank you for coming to my track meets. Thank you for coming to my church. The kids became very affectionate, and I became very close to them.
So you spent the whole school year with him and then came back the following fall. And I wonder, I mean, there were so many things that happened in the outside world that intruded into what was going on in the class. And the Paris attacks took place during the year you were there.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, Donald Trump began talking about excluding Muslims from the country. And then you would have come back the following fall. Did you come back after the presidential election, I wonder?
I did. And you know, I think regardless of what political party you belong to, regardless of who you voted for, the refugee crisis, it's a humanitarian crisis. And when you learn the stories of what families endure elsewhere, I think there are so many churches that are active doing refugee work because the Bible is completely clear. You know, our task is welcome the stranger, the Bible says. But I know a lot of voters in this election responded to Trump's rhetoric on this subject because we are afraid of terrorist attacks. And, you know, the news media especially makes us fearful with inundating us when these attacks occur with just a barrage of news about what's happening anytime there's a terror incident. And I'm not immune to that either, so I understand why people are fearful. But being inside South High School, I feel like the students there, the faculty there, they understand the world better than the rest of us. They have so much to teach us. So that was a fascinating place to be when the election took place. And the school was devastated by the outcome.
Well, there's much more to read in the book that we didn't get a chance to touch on today, and it's very multifaceted, very deep. The book is called The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom at South High School in Denver, the English Language Acquisition Program. Helen Thorpe wrote the book and joined us today in the exchange. Helen, thanks so much.